KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, the California State Legislature is scheduled to vote today on a package of bills to protect homeowners at risk of foreclosure. The legislation is backed by the Attorney General, but faces criticism from the California Bankers Association and others who say it will encourage frivolous litigation. The action comes as a new report finds that 11% of borrowers in the state are at risk of foreclosure. Join us for Forum next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Attorney General Kamala Harris is sponsoring a package of bills which the California State Legislature is slated to vote on today. The California Homeowners Bill of Rights promises to give full consideration to loan modification before foreclosure begins at a time when national foreclosures are in their fifth year and foreclosures have devastated California communities. Many financial service organizations, including the California Bankers Association, are opposed to the legislation, arguing that it could incentivize defaults and increase rates of foreclosure. We want to discuss the legislative package in this opening hour, and we also want to survey in the course of this hour the present California housing markets. Joining us, first of all, is Mike Eng. He's California Assemblyman for the 49th District, a Democrat from Alhambra, and co-author of the Homeowner Bill of Rights. Assemblyman, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
I guess I'd like to begin by just getting a picture of you from you of what this legislation will protect. I know that protection is what it's about, and we're talking about essentially residential mortgage services for all owner-occupant borrowers at risk of foreclosures, and about 11% are at risk of foreclosure. What will it do for them?
Thank you for the question. Every 13 seconds, someone in the United States of America is at risk of losing their home. About 500,000 households in California, we lead the nation. We had to do something. So what this bill does is, number one, it creates a level playing field for banks that were the result, subject to a recent foreclosure of about $25 billion for homeowners that were injured prior to the settlement. And what it does is it takes the best practices of the settlement moving forward in three particular areas. One, making sure that homeowners, when they call, they have a single point of contact of someone that can make decisions about their loan modification. Two, it makes sure that we don't have what we call dual tracking, where one person from a bank is negotiating in good faith and another person from that same bank is trying to foreclose on the property. And third, it limits the ability to sue. So what it does is it defines very specific measures in which one could use to get remedies.
It also prohibits filing of false documents, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, we took a term previously called robo-signing and said what it really means is that we can't use non-probative documents to file to foreclose on a property.
And this was, at least from what I'm reading, done behind closed doors. You didn't go through regular legislative channels or regular legislative process?
This legislation is a result of a very important conference committee. A conference committee is bipartisan, Republicans and Democrats, and it's bicameral, Assembly members and senators. We took about 20 hours of public testimony, probably a record for any type of legislation of this kind, and we had probably at least that many number of hours in private consultation with every stakeholder from banks, credit unions, consumer groups, homeowner associations, the Attorney General's office, other legislators, everyone who wanted to weigh in had a chance to meet with us.
Both, I believe, of the Republicans on the committee voted against the legislation. Is that correct?
On the committee, I believe one Republican voted against it, and I believe another, the senator, abstained.
Then what is the status presently? It's going to be voted on today?
Yes, today at around noon and there or thereafter, both the Assembly and the Senate will convene on their respective floors, and we hope to have a vote within 1 or 2 hours.
Again, Mike Eng with us by phone is California Assemblyman from the 49th District. He is a Democrat from Alhambra and co-author of the Homeowner Bill of Rights. Thank you for joining us, Assemblyman, and I appreciate very much your being with us to start things off here in this hour.
Well, thank you. My pleasure. This is a momentous point in history. California will be the first state to try to implement some of the best practices of the recent settlement.
Well, we're going to try to deconstruct this bill, and actually it's a package of bills, really. Let me tell you who else is with us to do that this hour. In studio, Paul Leonard is joining us. He's California Director of the Center for Responsible Lending. Welcome, Paul Leonard.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. Also good to have Christopher Thornburg, who's with us by phone from Southern California, Los Angeles. He's founding partner of Beacon Economics. They're an independent economic research and consulting firm, and they're headquartered in L.A. Welcome, Chris Thornburg.
Nice to be here.
And we also have with us Stuart Gabriel, who is with us as well from Southern California. He directs the UCLA Zeman Center for Real Estate and also Arden Realty Chair. He's also Arden Realty Chair and Professor of Finance at the UCLA Anderson School of Business. Welcome, Stuart Gabriel.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let me begin, Christopher Thornburg, with you. You're opposed to this legislation, and actually a consortium of financial service organizations have put out a report. Let's talk about what the problems are for you. I mean, for the main part, I guess you feel it's likely to slow housing recovery. Why?
Well, we have to keep something in mind. Well, there are a couple, I think, well-reasoned ideas at the very top level of these proposals. Underneath, what you really see is a variety of ways by which someone who's being foreclosed on can functionally extend the length of that foreclosure. There's, for example, getting rid of dual track processes. Sounds nice, but what that means, of course, is if someone goes through the process of modification and that modification fails, which, by the way, many, many modifications actually never work out, in large part because many of these borrowers aren't interested in making it work out. Because you can't do a dual track, what that means is the bank has to start all over again, and you could take something that, say, is already a remarkably long 13, 14-month process and turn it into a two-year process. Now,
let me just back up for a second with you, because
sure.
I was reading, well, some of the study from the other side. There was a study that was done on, well, delinquencies and foreclosures. And the figure they threw out was 80% of Californians who received modifications back in 2010 actually avoided default despite the recession.
I'm not sure about those numbers per se, but keep something in mind that those are folks who, quote unquote, received the modification. What they're not telling you is all the folks who were given a trial modification, but it never actually went through to final modification.
Okay,
which is a large number of folks.
So you're saying that that this could really backfire, but also reduce home values as well?
Well, yeah, ultimately, look, if you look around the nation today, what's interesting, of course, is the first two things you said. One is you talked about how neighborhoods have been devastated by the way of foreclosures. We heard something like every 13 seconds someone's in danger of foreclosure. I'm not exactly sure what that means. Realistically, California, which has one of the quickest and most efficient foreclosure processes, is actually sort of first out of the gate. The places that have longer foreclosure processes, such as Florida, for example, are still a total mess. Nevada, right in the middle of the process, went in, changed their foreclosure rules, made it much tougher for banks to foreclose on them, and their market is now languishing. California is over the hump. The number of delinquent mortgages are way down. 98% of foreclosed homes have been resold and have new residents living in them. Our system has proved itself to be quick, efficient, and ultimately most helpful to the California overall housing recovery. Why we need to change it at this stage, to me, well, it's like closing the barn door after the horse is long gone.
Aren't about one of three California homeowners underwater?
Well, first of all, there's two things going on here. One is being underwater. One is being not paying your loan back. Those are two completely separate issues. I don't think it's one out of three, by the way. I'm sure it's lower than that. But ultimately, why does being underwater have anything to do with foreclosure reform?
Well, I guess the real question boils down to whether or not this slows down the housing recovery and reduces home values, and really whether future credit availability for home buyers is affected.
Yeah, certainly it will be. Look, there's been numerous empirical studies, and keep in mind that this completely flies in the face of all empirical studies, because empirical studies have shown that when you start trying to legislate these things in, you don't really help a lot of folks. There's been no sort of increase in the number of workouts in a place like Florida, which has a very slow process compared to California, which has a short process. Ultimately, you actually encourage foreclosures. You know, one of the things that's constantly done by folks who support this legislation is they want to bring emotion into it. They'll find the anecdote, the person who had the stroke and had something terrible happen to them. But we have to keep something in mind. You have to take a step back and look at the market as a whole. And as a whole, this is a business transaction. And just as banks deal with this as a business transaction, so do most homeowners. Many folks out there today are going through what we call strategic default. These are folks who could pay their mortgage, but they realize, hey, I'm $150,000, $200,000 underwater. Ultimately, my credit score is going to heal faster than my equity. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sit here and ride this out. If I can get 2 years of free rent, 3 years of free rent, fantastic. I will do that. Enjoy my free time here in this property. They will eventually get rid of me, and then in a couple of years, I'll rent and go out and buy a new unit when my credit score heals. This is more common than the anecdotes of these folks who've fallen on tough times, and we have to stop building legislation around anecdotes and start building them around the reality of the market. It just makes me crazy when we do anecdote-based legislation.
We're talking again with Christopher Thornburg, who is founding partner of Beacon Economics. But this, we should remind listeners, is a package of bills, and you're not opposed to. I think, are you in support of the bill that deletes blight-enhanced protection of tenants or landlords subject to foreclosure?
Well, I think you mean the extension of, like, if you're a tenant of a property that's foreclosed on, I think you have 60 or 90 days
right.
notice they have to give you. I'm okay with that. I think that's fine. I'm even okay with this idea of having one point of contact. I think that makes a lot of sense. But again, dig a little deeper in here, and you'll see there's all sorts of uncertainties, all sorts of ways that can be that process can be slowed down. For example, in one of these rules and sort of the subtext, there's a thing that says if you have any reason to believe that the bank is using some false documents, you can file all sorts of lawsuits and stop the entire process in its track. That hasn't been fleshed out, but it's obviously a big worry for banks that see that as a potential for simply having, again, strategic defaulters using these provisions to extend their rent-free time in this property to as long a possible time as possible.
Well, let me go to Paul Leonard, who's here in the studio as California Director of the Center for Responsible Lending. You're kind of shaking your head here, Paul.
I am, yes. I'm not sure what legislation Chris has been reading. This legislation does a few simple things. Requires a borrower who applies for a loan modification to get a simple yes or no answer before the foreclosure process starts. The control of that is entirely left to the servicers. The rules about who gets the modification, entirely left to the servicers. But rather than having borrowers wrongfully started in the foreclosure process, they should be entitled to a simple yes or no answer. That's a common sense reform, and that is not going to slow down the foreclosure process. Similarly, the idea that the documents don't matter, that getting the documents right is not an important thing and we shouldn't really worry about that, seems to fly in the face of our common sense principles of democracy and due process, that you have a process in place for a foreclosure and that should be carried out and administered in a responsible way and that borrowers have every right to make sure that the documents that the servicers have are accurate before they take away their homes.
What's your take, though, on how effective this has been in places like Florida or Nevada or, for that matter, New Jersey?
Well, that's one of the areas where it doesn't seem like Chris has really read the legislation. This legislation does not change California into a judicial foreclosure process. California's non-judicial foreclosure process has worked effectively, has limited the time that is considered for the time frame in which foreclosures are processed. And the legislation does nothing to change that from a non-judicial into a judicial state. Similarly, the kinds of onerous requirements that have been put in place, mandatory mediation, while they may seem like it seems like a good idea, those are not the reforms that are included in this bill, which have slowed down the process in other states. Most importantly, I think, with respect to strategic defaulters, again, the problem has been that the servicers are overwhelmed. They do not have enough staff, don't have enough systems, don't have enough capacity to process foreclosures. Here in California, the time frame required by law to process a foreclosure is only about 120 days. And yet, the time that's being required to process foreclosures is about 270 days. I put that squarely on the capacity of the servicers, not on borrowers who are trying to drag out this process.
So the kind of opposition we're hearing from the financial service industry what is it, scare tactics?
I believe it is. I believe it is scare tactics. And I don't think that the study that that Chris Thornburg wrote for the California Bankers Association provides any specific evidence of how the foreclosure process will actually be lengthened as a result of this bill. We believe that if a borrower gets considered for alternatives to foreclosure up front, then the process will actually move quicker. And that the servicers can, once they've filed the notice of default starting the foreclosure process, they can simply go forward a 90-day period, file the notice of sale, and move forward to foreclosure. It will speed things up, and it will narrow the kinds of lawsuits that can be filed that borrowers can
are
filing
today. It's not going to encourage frivolous legislation, as the other side is saying?
No way will it encourage frivolous legislation. Okay. The law has been negotiated with moderate members of the legislature who are part of the conference committee to ensure that any lawsuits would have to be only for material violations that would give servicers the right to cure any violation before the sale of the house occurs. And it narrows the scope and it narrows the kinds of damages relative to the lawsuits that are being filed today, which are pretty much the Wild West and for which there aren't good rules in place.
And you mentioned, this is Paul Leonard, California Director of Center for Responsible Lending. You mentioned due process and your study, and we have kind of dueling studies here, but said 700,000 are at risk.
That's correct. I mean, that's as of February 2012. There are 700,000 California homeowners who are at least 30 days delinquent or in some stage of the foreclosure process. That doesn't count borrowers who are coming into the foreclosure process every month.
So what's wrong, Christopher Thornburg, with giving those people more due process?
Well, again, right off the bat, let's take a step back. That 700,000 number is wildly overblown because it includes 30 days late. And, you know, anybody who forgets to put a stamp on their mortgage check is 30 days late. There's always a large number of those. To throw those people into the mix is clearly intended to create some sort of shock and awe sort of effect. And he's also not acknowledging the fact that the situation is considerably better than it was a year and a half ago. We're clearly over the back end of this thing. The third thing is, to say this doesn't lengthen the foreclosure process, I'll give you the first thing, the prevention of dual-track foreclosures. Again, what he doesn't mention is for all the trial modifications, close to half of those don't actually go into an actual modification, and even then some of the people who get modifications end up simply dropping out. If you apply for one of these modifications and the bank is not allowed to pursue the other 3 or 4 month process along at the same time, you end up with a circumstance in which the bank has to go through the entire trial modification stuff, and then they have to start from scratch to go through the foreclosure process. To say that isn't going to lengthen the length of time for foreclosures is just wrong. Now, I agree. This is not putting us to a judicial state like Florida. It's certainly not even as draconian as things that were put into place in Nevada. But here's my fundamental question. We're over the hump on this. The market's already starting to heal. Why are we dealing with a foreclosure process that is more or less worked up to this point in time and instead focus on the real problem, which had to do with the fact that a lot of people borrowed money they should have never have borrowed? Why don't we focus on the roots of the problem, which go back to the real estate bubble and the crazy borrowing that was going on out there and the people who took out 3 or 4 home equity lines of credit? Why aren't we focusing on those processes as opposed to trying to paint the banks and the loan servicers as these bad guys? Yes, they've done some stuff in terms of the documents, but ultimately keep in mind 99.99% of people foreclosed on are being foreclosed on because they haven't paid their mortgage. They haven't paid their debt.
All right, let me jump in here because I want to give out the phone number, and those of you who are listening indeed may want to join us, and you can do that now at our toll-free number, which is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone call, so feel free to join us with any comments or questions you might have. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website or on our Facebook page. And let me bring Stuart Gabriel into this, who's Director of the UCLA Zeman Center for Real Estate and also Arden Realty Chair and Professor of Finance at the UCLA Anderson School of Business. From your perspective, Professor Gabriel, are we talking about something that's necessary in this legislation?
Well, let me try to bring some levity into this conversation. And what I'd like to do is...
Levity's always welcome, yeah.
Firstly, try to answer Chris's question of why are we talking about all this. The reason we're talking about all of this, unfortunately, is the fact that there was violation vis-a-vis the robo-signing of due process with respect to many homeowners and their foreclosure situation. So that in some respects we're here because of problems that were associated with overwhelmed banks that in fact were running very roughshod over this foreclosure process. Now, what we're looking for here, what the legislation's looking for here, and what we're looking for here as a society is fairness. And we need fairness with respect to the process that consumers go through, that homeowners go through as they make their way through the foreclosure process. But we also need fairness with respect to the financial institutions. The financial institutions need to be allowed to foreclose. If there was no opportunity to foreclose, we'd have no mortgage lending in this state. We'd have mortgage interest rates that were sky high relative to where they are today. So that the banks need to be treated fairly in this process as well, not be overregulated to the point where they're not allowed to do their business. A key to the housing recovery is the availability of credit, and is the availability of credit that is widespread in its availability and offered at today's low rates. One of the things that we hear oftentimes about this housing recovery is that credit is cheap in the sense that the Fed, together with the weakness of the economy, has made that credit cheap, but that credit is also tight. In other words, it's available only to a select few. And so the housing recovery is impeded by the tightness in credit. We need the banks to lend. And the way that we get the banks to lend is allow them to lend on terms whereby they can get their collateral back if the borrower doesn't perform. So again, what I'd say in sort of coming to a bottom line here is that we're here in part because of reprehensible action on the part of the banks with respect to the robo-signing debacle that should not be allowed, that should not have occurred, and everything in our power should be done to prevent something like that in the future. On the other hand, we can't allow dishonest borrowers to game the system, and to game the system vis-a-vis this series of activities that will allow them to live rent-free in a home and prevent the foreclosure process from going forward as it should.
It's a pretty delicate balance you're talking about. And by the way, we're coming up on a break. And again, Stuart Zeman with us from L.A. is director of the UCLA Zeman Center for Real Estate, Stuart Gabriel. We're going to go to a break, but when we come back, we'll hear more from you. And actually, I want to talk to Stuart Gabriel because I want to get a sense from him of just the market on a whole, the whole picture, if I could, of the housing market in California. But we also want to hear from you, and if you'd like to join us again, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, and there are other ways to communicate with us, any questions or comments you might have by email, forum@kqed.org, or posting any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. We'll get interactive shortly enough. But we talked earlier with Mike Eng, California Assemblyman from the 49th District, who is the co-author of the Homeowner's Bill of Rights, which is what we're talking about, which comes before the California legislature later today. We'll continue with Christopher Thornburg from Beacon Economics and with Paul Leonard from the Center for Responsible Lending, and as I said, with Stuart Gabriel, who's also Arden Realty Chair and Professor of Finance at UCLA's Anderson School of Business. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Later today, the California State Legislature is scheduled to vote on a package of bills to protect homeowners at risk of foreclosure. And legislation is backed by the Attorney General, but has faced criticism by the California Bankers Association and others in the financial services industry who say it will encourage frivolous litigation. We've heard both sides of that argument here this morning. And a new report finds that 11% of borrowers in the state are at risk of foreclosure. We're talking with Paul Leonard here in studio, California Director of the Center for Responsible Lending, and Christopher Thornburg, who's with us by phone from Los Angeles, founding partner of Beacon Economics, and Stuart Gabriel, who directs the UCLA Zeman Center for Real Estate, and is also Arden Realty Chair and Professor of Finance at UCLA's Anderson School of Business. We're going to go to your calls and emails shortly here. I said before the break, though, I want to go back to Professor Gabriel and just get a picture from you, Stuart Gabriel, if I can, of really the markets in the state. And there's a lot of difference. I mean, you know, here in San Francisco, for example, where we're broadcasting from, the market looks pretty good. People moving in from China and L.A. and New York. On the other hand, real estate investors have bought up about close to half of Oakland's foreclosure homes. And there are big differences in the markets in the state, say, between the coast and the interior. I mean, I know when we talk about California, we're talking about this gargantuan picture. But what's the general picture?
Well, when I grew up here in California, I grew up in Northern California. In those days, the state was divided north and south. In fact, there was even an initiative to actually legally divide the state. Yeah, for the listener today to think about California housing markets, think also about dividing the state, but as you've said, divide it between the coast and the interior. And the coast includes some of the hottest markets in the country, certainly San Francisco among them. Numerous reports that suggest that there's inadequacy of supply of new home. Rents are rising 4 to 5% annually. There's shortage of housing and all the rest. Imagine coastal Southern California that bears some similarity, where Santa Monica looks a lot closer to San Francisco than it does to the rest of L.A., where there's tech employment in Santa Monica, urban amenities that look very similar to that of San Francisco and the like. But as you move east into the state, you move to the epicenter of the implosion in housing nationally. And in those areas, the housing recovery is still, in some cases, a couple of years away. Now, it's not that the two areas are unlinked. In fact, they're, of course, linked geographically, and they're part of larger areas of economic activity. Research that we have recently done at UCLA and at the Ziman Center is suggestive of the fact that there is contagion across these markets. There was contagion across these markets going into the housing downturn, and it's undoubtedly the case that if the recovery, the economic recovery, takes hold in the United States, in the global economy, and in the state of California, those are big ifs, and I can talk about those ifs momentarily. But if that recovery were to take place, we would not only see continued resurgence of the coastal housing markets, but we would also see gradually improvement in housing market conditions spread to the east, to areas like Stockton, California. Just recently declared bankruptcy in Stockton, California. House prices have fallen on order of magnitude of 60%. But bear in mind that in many of these areas, the combination of a 50 or 60% reduction in house prices, together with record low mortgage interest rates, makes for tremendous improvements in affordability. And that, of course, lays the seeds for the recovery.
Now, the highest foreclosure rates, though, now are in the Central Valley and the Inland Empire, as I understand it. But you've got also upstate here, real collapse of markets, don't you?
When you say upstate, you mean areas of Northern California?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Stockton. Yeah.
Well, the interior of the state from north to south is characterized by substantially weaker conditions. And, of course, that's characteristic of Sacramento going down Highway 99, the entirety of the Central Valley, into the inland area, Temecula, and all the rest. So it's all part of a larger area of overbuilding and of tremendously weak economic conditions. Now, let me get back perhaps to a central theme, which is that we typically see housing leading the U.S. economy, where the housing sector is a cyclically sensitive sector. It will lead the economy into a downturn and oftentimes lead the economy out of a downturn. Today, and in the context of this implosion in the global economy, the U.S. economy, and the California economy, housing has been a lagging sector. That housing is finally an engine of growth. We're seeing across a large number of indicators improvement in housing activity to the extent that we can largely agree that housing has turned a corner, and we're very hopeful about housing. The problem is that housing is improving in the context of a larger economic recovery, which is both threatened and also with numerous wild cards, such as the wild card of the recession in Europe, potential capital markets and banking crisis in Europe and all the rest. So housing today is improving. In a U.S. economy where manufacturing is slowing, employment growth is slow, unemployment rates are high and remaining to be and expected to remain high, and confidence is waning.
Now, I hear hopefulness in your voice, though, and that's encouraging, although I must say that Paul Leonard had said to me, getting back to this package of bills that we've been talking about that the California State Legislature will be voting on today, this is Waterloo, you described, Paul Leonard?
Yes, I did. I did. We've been trying to get dual tracking stamped out of California's foreclosure process for the last 3 years. The effort this year, led by Attorney General Kamala Harris, modeled on a national foreclosure settlement that was endorsed and supported by 49 governors, Republicans and Democrats alike, to try and establish some basic servicing standards, has given this a new momentum with full support and leadership, not just from the leadership of both the Assembly and the Senate, but also some of the more moderate members who, like Senator Calderon, a member of the conference committee who has opposed this in the past and who negotiated carefully a series of safeguards to ensure that we were balancing the spectrum between foreclosure protections for consumers and housing market protections for those people who are participating in housing markets.
Right. I do want to bring our callers in, and let's bring in as many of you as we can. Let's begin, Casey, with you. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
The one gentleman was defending the banks and saying that people need to pay their mortgages, and the banks didn't have the money to loan, and they couldn't pay their bills, and that's why these people are defaulting on them and doing everything they can to keep their houses, because they gave them a loan for an artificially inflated price, and then were bailed out based on that price, and now they don't want to share any of that loss with their customers.
And let me get some response to what you've just characterized from Christopher Thornburg.
It's not quite as simple as that, of course. I never have said that the problems in lending weren't very acute. There was a complete breakdown in the credit process. But, you know, the worst of the worst weren't actually mortgages that went through the big banks that this is targeting. Most of those went through these subprime lenders, the so-called conduit lenders that were so many made home in Costa Mesa, so-called subprime alley. These are the folks who actively encouraged many borrowers to commit fraud on their mortgage applications, lying about their incomes under affidavit, and packing those just awful mortgages into these mortgage-backed securities, and selling those off to various investors across the globe. That process was awful. It needs to be legislated out of existence. I don't think there's any room in the mortgage market for that. But given that, that's a completely separate issue than this idea of basically slowing down the foreclosure process here in the state. Keep in mind, it's not going to be the banks or the loan services that are going to pay for this ultimately. It's going to be future California homeowners who are going to face basically tougher credit standards as a result of this package of rules. So in a very real sense, we punish future home buyers in some sort of quixotic attempt to help these current homeowners who are behind on mortgages. And I don't get that at all. So I think the trade-off the caller is trying to set up just doesn't exist the way he thinks.
All right, I want to get more callers on, and let me go to Richmond next. Faye, your home is in foreclosure right now?
Yes, it is.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh, thank you. I've been trying desperately to work something out with HUD and with the HAMP program, with other programs. I have been looking for work diligently. I lost my job. I'm trying to see if somehow I can utilize this these package of bills or somehow get some help to stall the foreclosure so that when I get a job, I can work something out with the bank.
Well, let's find out about whether you can be helped. I mean, the timing on this, Paul Leonard, would it help someone like in her position?
Well when this bill will take effect January 1st, 2013, so it is not likely to provide immediate relief for somebody who has already begun the foreclosure process. There may be a possibility that they would be assisted, depending on who the servicer or the lender is, by the terms of the Attorney General's settlement, if it was one of the five signatories. And one of the important things about this bill is that it levels the playing field. It makes sure that borrowers are not penalized depending on who their bank or servicer happens to be. Mm-hmm. Everybody would play by the same set of rules.
Well, good luck to you,
Faye. Thank you kindly.
Thank you for the call. Here's Noah, who writes on our Facebook page, make California more business-friendly so people won't lose their jobs and can keep making payments. Some more of your comments I'm just going to read here. Robert from Palo Alto says, let's keep in mind that it was irresponsible lending that caused the bubble in the first place. We're being very patient with people who have engaged in unethical practices. If it were up to me, they'd be required to eat any mortgages that didn't make financial sense in the first place. And another listener, James, says Florida's process is slow because all bankruptcies must all go to court. There is no parallel. Mike in San Jose writes, every time I hear the housing market is improving, I get annoyed. Cheap everything is good. Computers, telephones, pencils, and houses. When the government seeks to support people who can't or don't want to pay their mortgage, they are discriminating against tens of millions of people who want prices to come down to their natural level so that they can afford a home. Dr. Krasny, every time you hear a phrase like help for troubled homeowners, I'd like you to say, what about help for the home buyers who have a right to cheaper housing? What are your response, Stuart Gabriel, to an email like that where he says he gets annoyed when he hears the housing market is improving?
Well, that's sort of an odd way of describing things, in the sense that we should all be greatly relieved when our macroeconomy is improving, because when our macroeconomy improves, it creates jobs and incomes and opportunities that are widespread, including hopefully those for the writer of that email. I will say, however, that markets need to clear. And as markets clear, economic activity can rebound. We have a very interesting example that you talked about earlier, Florida versus California, with respect to judicial foreclosure, where Florida is not even close to a rebound in housing, whereas California is really very adroitly moving forward. But an international example of that is the 1990s Japan versus the United States. And in the 1990s, from a Japanese perspective, are called the lost decade. Whereas here in the United States during the 1990s, we let our real estate markets downward adjust. And as those markets downward adjust, we cleared out excess inventory. We let prices fall. And that really sowed the seeds for a remarkable recovery that we had subsequent to that. So we do need to let markets work in this particular case. And I think that will help us get to the goal that we all want, which is a full-blown resurgence in economic activity across the board.
And again, Stuart Gabriel directs the UCLA. It's Ziman Center, right? I'm sorry.
It is Ziman Center.
I know somebody with that name who pronounces Ziman, so my apologies to the Ziman Center for Real Estate. Apologies.
Not a problem.
To the Ziman family or whomever. Let me go to more of your calls. In the meantime, we go to TJ next. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. Regarding this bill that's in the legislature, I just wanted to confirm, if someone knows the details here, that this is not in any part of it going to repeal the current law that when a person is foreclosed on and the house is sold and less than what's owed on the notice recovered from the sale, that they can't go after the borrower for that difference.
And Paul Leonard.
No, there is no change in what are called the deficiency, anti-deficiency standards, and there are this legislation does not address those provisions at all.
May I make one more comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
Just want to keep hearing some of the callers really sort of blaming borrowers here for the situation, borrowing too much here. That anti-deficiency position comes out of the Depression and goes to a balancing between lenders and borrowers, asking the question, who is in a better position to evaluate the wisdom of the loan? A lender who makes thousands of these, or a borrower who may be doing it only once or twice? And the decision was that lenders are in a better position to evaluate whether or not the loan should be made in the first place. So I would really be blaming lenders for this situation and not the borrowers. Thank you.
Okay, we thank you for that statement. And apropos of that statement, let me go to some emails here. Here's David, who says, Your first guest said the new California foreclosure law will prohibit robo-signing. Isn't robo-signing already illegal? Submitting documents with forged signatures to a court is fraud. Why hasn't the California Attorney General prosecuted the banks for criminal fraud? Why haven't the local district attorneys prosecuted the banks for criminal fraud? It sounds like a slam-dunk case to me. And another listener, James, says, I'm having difficulty following Mr. Thornburg. Every time a statistic is mentioned, he counters that there are many exceptions, suggesting or even stating that the statistic is misleading, but does not quantify many. He also discounts anecdotal evidence, but fails to provide more than vague hints of numbers and, at best, anecdotal counter-evidence. As one of the discounted anecdotes myself, I find that a bit offensive. In addition, the demonizing of irresponsible borrowers is equally offensive. During the height of the boom, I received unsolicited offers to refinance at a rate of about one or two per week. If I didn't have a minor in mathematics and my undergraduate degree and a couple decades of borrowing experience, I might have been one of those horribly irresponsible borrowers taking money from the helpless professionals who make lending decisions professionally many times each day. I think the California Homeowner Bill of Rights is great and overdue. And John writes, how many homeowners are gaming this system? Any hard numbers, or is this blaming the victim? Let me go to you on this, Chris Thornburg.
Please. In terms of the quote-unquote vague numbers, I'm not sure what he means by that. There's been, for example, here's a basic statistic. At the peak, something on the order of 7.5% of all mortgages in California were seriously delinquent 6 or more days behind. That is not since dropped to about 4%, a little over 4%. As for the trial modifications that don't make it to overall, I'm dodging that number because I know it's been updated. When the programs first started, something on the order of 80% of all trial modifications didn't make it to final modification. I think today, something on the order of 40 to 45% of trial modifications never make it to final modification in terms of the overall loan things. So, I mean, there are specific numbers there, and no, I'm not waving my hands in order to try and hide something. What was the other? There were so many various attacks in there, Michael.
I was kind of clustering them together. I wanted to give you opportunity to use your best rhetoric here, but yeah.
And again, I completely agree with both that last caller that says the problem here was the lending process. Absolutely. I'm not arguing that for a second. The lending process should never have been allowed to get out of control like that. My question is, where does this address the lending process? Nowhere in here is the lending process. What this does is it makes foreclosure more costly for lenders, which punishes future home buyers.
Let me go to the heart of your question. Where does this approach the lending process, Paul Leonard?
This bill does not address the lending process. What this bill does is provide some measure of fairness and relief for the victims of the lending process that Chris has said was fundamentally broken. I should be clear to point out the largest lender in the United States during the boom was a little company called Countrywide. They were the worst of the worst. They have been acquired by Bank of America, and we are continuing to dig ourselves out of the really horrific lending that was done and that Chris wants to just pretend didn't exist and doesn't want to do anything to ensure that borrowers who can afford to stay in their homes, pay a little bit less on their mortgage, will have be afforded the fair consideration and the opportunity to do so.
Well, let me get to some more of our callers here. Danielle has been waiting patiently. Join us, please, and welcome. Thanks for waiting.
Hello. Thank you for putting me on. I just have a curious question. You said recently that most of the homes in Oakland and around the Bay Area are being bought up by investors. And
no, specifically Oakland. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Correct. And I'm in a home buyer now, and I'm noticing often we put bids on homes and we're bought out with people who pay cash and over the asking price. It seems like the people in the area are unable to secure a house because the market is so explosive at this point in this area. And it seems like the people who are in their homes now who actually can modify their loans should be able to be given the right to try and modify.
Well, Stuart Gabriel, let's get some comment from you on that.
We do see a lot of investor activity in the coastal markets, and there is some attempt in a way to demonize some of that activity, but we should bear in mind that these investors in many cases are helping to stabilize prices. They're helping to take inventory off the market. They're providing rental housing in many cases where rental housing is needed. They're also taking pressure off of residential rents in areas where residential rents have risen very markedly. So that, and these investors, of course, in some cases, are allowing previously foreclosed upon families to actually remain in the residence on a rental basis. So we have to be careful as we demonize the investor community. The investor community is working in the way that we would hope the markets would work to again, help stabilize these markets.
All right. I'm looking at a listener who posted on our website. For the record, Mr. Thornburg is one of the few prominent economists who predicted the housing crash in California when almost everyone else was in denial around 2006. He knows what he's talking about. Looking at some other of your comments, listener writes, my wife and I just tried to refinance so we could lower our monthly payment by about $250 per month. We have perfect credit, $75,000 in equity in our home, a higher than average income, and we were denied. If we can't refinance, how could someone who really needs it? This seems absurd. These low interest rates are out of reach to the poor and middle class. And another listener raises a question here. According to this morning's, it's about this morning's foreclosure hour, he says, is there any way to hold accountable the bank that foreclosed a home from failing to prevent squatters occupying the home? Think of the recent swarm of house fires that squatters have caused. I don't know who would like to comment on that, but I think it's an important question. Maybe you, Chris Thornburg, or Stuart Gabriel?
I can weigh in somewhat on that. I mean, yes, there is, of course, a provision in here which, you know, makes sure that the servicers maintain the property. And I actually think that's probably one of the better parts of this package of bills. Obviously, we do want to maintain those properties. And ultimately, it should be in the servicer's best interest to do that. After all, a house that's in good shape is going to sell for more than one that's destroyed or, God forbid, burned down. So that would seem like a logical thing to do.
Yeah, and let me get another caller on. That's you, Ryan. Hi.
Hey, Michael. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
Good. You know, listen, I'm a mortgage broker here in San Francisco, and listening to Chris's comments, two things that are just blatantly obvious to me. One of them is that there are actors in the banking market. You know, I've tried to help out borrowers, and you know, throughout the last year and a half, it's kind of slowed down a little bit. But 2 years ago, I would get calls from borrowers and clients and say, hey, you know, I'm in this process. And Bank of America came up so often as being just a bad dealer. And I don't know if it's because they took over Countrywide and couldn't manage that debt load that was kind of pushed in their direction when they did acquire Countrywide. But, you know, you're talking about fraud. And I think when there's fraud that happens, an application going in for a loan modification and that application going into a shredder, you know, these people were good, hardworking people. I'm not dismissing the fact that there were a lot of people out there that were in homes that they should have never bought and that there was a lot of bad acting on both sides, borrowers and lenders. But when you have somebody who's going into a good faith situation with the loan modification process and they get the absolute runaround and are lied to, I think that's where a lot of the anger stems from.
All right. I thank you for those comments, Ryan. And I'm looking at some comments from a listener in an email who raises a question specifically about the bill. And Paul Leonard, let me go to you on this. He wants to know, will this bill have teeth? With all due respect to the bank representative, this was not simply due to people's borrowing too much. It was and is driven due to banks committing and encouraging fraud. This dovetails with the last caller, though he did indicate both sides were culpable, and I would agree. But he says a national effort to avoid clear title laws and other illegal efforts. That has so far been met with negotiations, minor fines relative to profits, and blanket immunity. What reason do we have to believe that this will be enforced?
Well, I think one of the hallmarks of this legislation is that there are specific provisions in the bills that will allow homeowners to bring their servicer to file a legal action against their servicer if they fail to follow the provisions of the law.
So there will be more litigation.
Well, we believe that this meaningful enforcement is critically important, not to create some avalanche of new litigation, but actually to narrow the scope of what borrowers can sue on now, number one, and number two, and most importantly, to encourage the servicers once and for all to build systems that work. We heard from the previous caller about the runaround that servicers have gotten, about repeated lost documents, about all of the problems that we have heard about since this crisis began and which the servicers have never been able to catch up with. We hope that this will create meaningful incentives for the first time and once and for all for the servicers to create a process that's fair and provides full consideration to borrowers for a loan modification before they start the foreclosure process.
But the word we keep hearing from Chris Thornburg and the servicers is this could de-incentivize default and increase foreclosure rates. Christopher Thornburg?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the key. I mean, look, I don't have any problem with streamlining things. I think we ought to be working towards a system that is more fair for borrowers. It gives them a clean idea of what's going on. Information is always a good thing. But this is really designed at its base to lengthen the foreclosure process. I mean, it was said right up front in the press release that came out from the Attorney General's office where she said, we want to give people more time in order to catch up. Well, that's not how the market's supposed to work, and ultimately that will punish future home buyers by making credit less available.
All right, you get the final word because we are out of time, and you can continue this, you listeners, on our website, comments and continued discussion and dialogue by going to kqed.org/forum or going to our Facebook page. I want to thank Christopher Thornburg, who again is founding partner of Beacon Economics. They're an independent economic research and consulting firm headquartered in L.A. Thanks also to Stuart Gabriel, director of the UCLA Ziman Center for Real Estate, and he is Arden Realty Chair and Professor of Finance at UCLA's Anderson School of Business. We thank Paul Leonard, who joined us here in studio, California Director for the Center for Responsible Lending, and Assembly Mike Eng, who joined us at the top of the hour, co-author of the Homeowners Bill of Rights. We will watch what happens later this afternoon. Thank you for being a part of the program. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And we remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our Facebook page. Also want to thank Senior Editor Dan Zoll and our producers, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Amanda Stupai, and Amy Machado. Our engineer today is Paul Lancour, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.